final study in the Gospel of John. We're into the 21st chapter, the last chapter in the book. We started into it last week as we saw the first point up here on the board, the manifestation of Jesus as he appeared on the scene. And we'll start with the invitation that Jesus gives these men in chapter 9, verse 9 through 14. It's been a very interesting study. As John set forth to present the evidence that would convict us that Jesus truly who he claimed to be, the Son of God. That was his intent, his purpose in writing in John 20, verse 30 and 31. As he finishes out the book, in the next to the last chapter, he tells us why he wrote it. He said, truly many other signs did Jesus in the presence of his disciples that's not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that believing you might have life in his name. And so that's why John is referred to by and has been referred to by many over the centuries, the last two centuries, as the gospel of faith, the gospel of belief. Now Luke, he wrote his gospel to most excellent Theophilus, which is some high mucky muck in a Roman Empire. We don't know who he was. All we know from studying documents and letters from that time is that the only men who carried the title most excellent in the Greek was men of high authority in the Roman government. Anyway, he wrote to Theophilus. Matthew, he wrote to the mind of the Jew in his gospel. It's pretty clear that he did because he gives no explanation as to the Jewish systems and customs and traditions and their operation under the law. Whoever he's writing to, which is the Jews, understood very clearly those points. So he didn't explain, but now Mark, he wrote to the Gentile mind because he goes and explains all of the Jewish holiday systems and their mode of worship. So he wrote to people that wasn't Jews. So anyway, that was John's purpose in writing this. And here in the epilogue of his book, this morning, he presents to us the invitation of Jesus. Let's read this section, verse 9 through 14. As soon then as they were come to the land, the apostles were fishing. They saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid thereon, and bread. And Jesus said unto them, bring of the fish which ye have now caught. And Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of great fishes, 153. And for all there were so many, yet was not the net broken. And Jesus said unto them, come and dine. And none of the disciples durst ask him, who art thou? Knowing that it was the Lord. You remember he's already told them that they fished all night and didn't catch nothing up in verse 6. And he told them to cast the net on the right side of the boat. And they did. And it was more than the boat could take in the net. And so they assured that this is the Lord that's standing there in the darkness of that morning. That is, he invites them to shore and to dinner. And so none of the, verse 12, and then Jesus said to them, come and dine. And none of the disciples asked him, who art thou? Because they knew it was the Lord. And Jesus then cometh and taketh bread and giveth them, and fish likewise. This is now the third time that Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was risen from the dead. The third time. And so when they had dined, Jesus said unto Simon Peter, well, that's as far as we're going to read in this section. An observation of what he said here, of what happened. The invitation of Jesus to eat was a call to the resumption of the fellowship which his death had broken. They went fishing, and he was in the grave 3 days and three nights, and now he's risen. And if they had previously doubted their own senses or his identity on the occasion when he appeared to them as a group, they could no longer, because verse 12 says they knew that it was the Lord, no doubt about it. Doubtless, they had eaten in this fashion many times beside the lake with the Lord. His return to them would renew the continuity of their life and him, the continuity. And the fact that he ate with them would strengthen the conviction that he was really before them. Peter must have been especially impressed by this, for he referred to it later in his preaching in Acts 10 and verse 41. He refers to the fact that they ate with the Lord. The invitation of Jesus was designed to show that personal contact with him that was possible after the resurrection. Now verse 15 through 17 goes in to present a new motivation and a new occupation. Let's read verse 15 through 17. So when they had dined, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? And he said unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. And he said unto him, feed my lambs. He saith to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? And he said unto him, yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. And he said unto him, feed my sheep. And in verse 17, he said unto him the third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Now Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. And Jesus said unto him, feed my sheep. Although Jesus had already appeared to Peter privately, on which occasion he may have well restored Peter to his fellowship after Peter had denied him at his trial, cursed and swore that he didn't know the man, Jesus, dealing with him at this time, restrained him publicly before the other disciples and also conveyed Jesus' desire for a new motive in service. Incidentally, that's the basis of our service, because we love that one that sacrificed his life that we might live. And it's out of that love that our devotion to him comes forth. I've mentioned this before, and it needs mentioned again. Salvation is a free gift. That's Ephesians 2, 8 through 10. For by grace are you saved through your faith, and that not of yourselves. It's nothing you've done. that not of yourselves, it's a gift of God. A free gift. Nothing you can do for it. Not one thing. You lay hold on it by your acknowledgement of Jesus and being baptized for the remission of sins. But you're laying hold on a free gift. You didn't deserve it. You weren't worthy of it. He gave it to you. So, for by grace are you saved through your faith, and that not of yourselves is a gift of God. It's just God's gift to you. Not of your works, lest any man should boast. Nothing we done. We can't boast of anything we do. But what we do is a matter of gratitude. Because and the reason we can't boast is that verse goes ahead and says, for we are his workmanship. You see, he done the work. He done the work. We didn't. He done the work. And give us this free gift. But he created us unto good works. Now, what is that motivation in that creation? What causes us to move toward service to the Lord? Love. Appreciation for what he done for us. And so salvation is truly a free gift. We understand it's an undeserved gift, because in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly, not willing that any man should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And so it's a free gift, it's an undeserved gift, but it is a demanding gift. Now the demand is not in the price of the gift, because it's free. The demand is in the thanksgiving of the gift. As Paul will state somewhere, I forget where it's at, he said, thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift. And only when you and I come to realize the ugliness of sin and become the man as described in Romans 7 that cries out, O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of sin and death? When you become that person and obey the gospel, then out of that gratitude for what he's done for you, you offer him everything in your life. We're going to talk about it this morning in regard to how death becomes life. That's the principle. That is the nature of true religion. It's not practiced very much. There's a remnant, a small group in the Lord's kingdom that does that. And so here Jesus is dealing with Peter and in front of the other apostles. This is a public thing before the 12. Peter's eager to see Jesus, and evidenced by his hurried departure from the boat when John said, it is the Lord, in verse 7, it was in itself a testimony to his devotion. But Jesus wanted him to declare himself unmistakably. How do we declare our faith unmistakably? Exactly what the Lord said here. Feed my sheep. If you love me, feed my sheep. That's the responsibility of every one of us. We're all sheep. And you get to Romans 14, just to make a long story short, Paul talks about the weaker brother and the stronger brother. And what you need to recognize there is all of us are weaker brothers in some things. And all of us are stronger brothers in some things. And we're to deal with one another understanding that. The weaker brother, we help him. He's allowed to lean on us, and we accept it. That's our job toward a brother, if we happen to be the stronger brother at that moment. Another occasion, we might be the weaker brother and depend on somebody else. But we're all the weaker brother and all the stronger brother in Romans 14. And we have a duty toward one another. And here Jesus is talking about the motivation and occupation of these disciples and consequently of you and me. All right, so this threefold question here where Jesus put to him, "Lovest thou me?" This was public in front of the other apostles for a reason. Jesus doesn't talk to Peter and his, you know, in private. And now he's speaking to him publicly. He said he was searching Peter's deepest motives, because love is the motive that drives a person into service for the Lord. The Apostle Paul wrote 13 of the New Testament epistles, and in practically every one of them, I think, he referred to himself as a bond slave. Now, a bond slave is one bought with a price. And he recognized that the price that bought him was what he stated to the elders in Acts 20, verse 28. He charged them. He said, "Take heed unto yourself, you elders at Ephesus, and unto the flock over which the Holy Ghost has made you to be overseers. Feed the church of God, which God purchased with God's blood." And Paul understood he was a purchased possession. The Lord never made him a slave, but his love for his master and what the master done for him made him a slave. And it'll make you a slave also when you come to love the Lord. As I've said before, and I'll say it again, we're not commandment keepers. We're God lovers. And because we love God, we keep his commandments. Now that sounds like kind of a fancy way of saying it, but it does cause us to stop and think. We're not Christians because we just keep commandments. We keep those commandments because of our devotion and love to the one that died for us and gave us life. And so here Jesus is dealing with this with Peter. And so 2 times in this initial questioning, Jesus said, "Peter, do you love me?" Now, the verb employed there is agapo in the Greek, the same as the one used of love in John 3:16. God so loved, which speaks of the love of God. And when Peter answered, he used another verb, phileo. And so the Lord began by asking Peter, "Peter, do you agape me? Do you love me? Do you agape me?" Peter said, "Yea, Lord, you know I phileo you," which implies friendship or fondness. In the third question, Jesus uses Peter's own words, which implied that he doubted the genuineness of Peter's profession. This interpretation gives point to the statement that Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, "Lovest thou me?" in verse 17. And Peter was not upset because Jesus questioned him 3 times, but because on the third occasion, Jesus challenged his sincerity. You can see that, how Peter would look on that being asked 3 times. One right after another. "Do you love me? Feed my sheep." And there's also the impression of a mission that they had. The reality of the distinction between these two words, agape and phileo, has been disputed on 2 grounds. First, the conversation between Jesus and Peter, though recorded in Greek, probably was carried on in Aramaic. The contention is that differentiation occurs, for there is only one word for love, and in the Syriac or the Aramaic version, the same word is used to render both Greek words. And incidentally, we've mentioned it before, I'll mention it again. The Greek is recognized as the most explained, ex, explainable, I guess you would say, language that there is. Languages didn't come by men. Man has not invented a language. God brought the languages about when they was building the Tower of Babel. They were not doing what he commissioned them to do, to go into all the world. They're all settled in one place and going to build that tower. So the Lord went down there and confused their languages so they couldn't finish it. God is the one who gives us the languages. And the Greek, you remember we've talked about, what's that conqueror's name?
Alexander
the Great. When he conquered the world in about 280 B.C., by the commission of God, he established the Koine, or the common man's Greek, everywhere he established. He would take a continent or a province or a government, and he would leave behind teachers to teach them the Koine Greek, and the purpose of it was for universal trade, kind of like English is used for universal trade today. Then on the day of Pentecost, there were Jews from every nation under heaven gathered there, and that's what amazed them is they all knew the Koine Greek because it was worldwide, but these apostles spoke to them in all their native languages, and so they had their native language plus they understood the Koine Greek. Kind of like when you hear these diplomats from other countries on the news. They have some difficulty, some of them do, of speaking English, but they have their own language, and then they have, then they speak American, because being a diplomat, that's a common language for trade. Well, that's what Alexander set up, and it's understood by the scholarly of the world that the Koine Greek is the most intense language there is. One example, this example of this word love. In the Greek, there's three flexions of love. There's agape, phileo, and I don't remember what the other one was. But their love is spoken of in three different depths or three different realms. Where in the English, it's just love. And that's why our King James just says, love. Jesus asked him three times, lovest thou me more than these? So there is a play on words there between Jesus and Peter, agape and phileo. And you can take it from there and study it out if you want to. But it's clear enough in and of itself. Again, the two words at times are used interchangeably in this gospel. Both represent God's love for man, that's agapo, in chapter 14, 23, 17, 23. You can find these in a concordance. And phileo, the other word, is used in 16:27. Both are employed to describe the Father's love for the Son, as agape in 3:35 and 17:23 and 24 and 26, and phileo in 5:20. And they also denote Jesus' love for men. Agapo in 11:5 and phileo in 11:3. That's used to speak of his love for men. This latter instance is striking, since both verbs apply to Lazarus, a distinction between them cannot be pressed. In other words, you can't really make a definite distinction between the two. Lastly, both indicate the love of men for Jesus, agapo, in 14, 15, 21, 23, 24, 28, and phileo at 16:27. Now, I'm sure that you got all of that, didn't you? I'm sure you did. But I've laid it out there in case you're curious about it and you want to study it further. There it is. You can look it up in the concordance. Now, to the first objection, the answer may be given that the Greek is more flexible than the Arabic, and that the use of a singular word for all degrees and types of love may signify the poverty of Arabic rather than confusion in Greek. In replying to this section, this second objection, one may say that the frequent interchange of terms as exact synonyms does not mean that they are absolute equivalents, but only that they may be used as approximately equivalent in each case. It is true that agapo is a more dignified term, while phileo connotes mainly emotional warmth and intensity. And that being the case, when Jesus asked Peter, do you agape me? He was asking of that deeper love that goes to God. And Peter said, well, I have a warm feeling for you. Being honest, that's the way it is. But anyway, that was the nature of this discussion here. And both these words are to be distinguished from E-R-A-O, which is never used in the New Testament, and which invariably means physical love. And that word's not used. It's not a physical love he's talking about. That's the idea. In any case, Jesus was seeking to probe Peter's innermost purpose in following him. So here we're dealing, Jesus is dealing with purpose. What's your purpose, Peter? The desire for personal success, eminence, achievement, reward, or even the relatively unselfish motive of doing something for needy humanity was not enough. Only a complete love for Christ would be sufficient to carry him and his fellow disciples through the careers which awaited them in the future of being his apostles. That's the only thing that will carry us through, is love for God. We have problems with one another. You know, we see one another as, well, simply the fact that you're ugly and your mama dresses you funny. We see one another in that light. We don't always agree with one another. But why do we love one another? Because we first love God. And because God created every one of us. And because it's very clear from the New Testament that if a man doesn't love God's children in the physical world, his children that he created, you can't claim to love God. And there again, that opens another box of depth in understanding. In the fact that each one of us, don't care who you are or what your physical features are, you were created by God purposely. You're not an accident. We tend to look upon all this humanity out here, 7 billion people in the world. And we just assume, well, those are just accidents that come along, you know. Under the law of procreation. No. When you read Genesis and how God breathed into Adam the breath of life, that's a reality with every one of us. We wouldn't have life because life comes from him. We are special is what I'm trying to say. Each one of us are special. You'll never find a duplicate or a copy. Never will. Or you find somebody that may look like you, but not completely. because of your uniqueness. You're like a snowflake. They claim there's no two of them alike. There isn't. That makes us very precious. That makes the ungodly very precious. When Jesus died at Calvary, it says, "And while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly." When he died for us, he saw the preciousness in us, in our coming to the knowledge of the truth and obeying it. And so, here is their work with the creation of God. Their work, and they needed to be impressed with the fact that it stems from the love of God. Everything stems from the love of God. Remember when Jesus was asked by the Pharisees, what's the greatest of the law? They weren't looking for information. They were looking to trap him in his words so they could kill him before his time. And they weren't expecting what he said. He said, the greatest of the law is to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And second's like it unto it, love your neighbors yourself. And he didn't stop there. Sometimes we stop there when we mention that, but he didn't. He said, on these two, loving God and loving your neighbor, hangs all of the law and the prophets. And so what compels and constrains a man to be obedient to what they learn from the Father, that his wishes are what he wants? In this case, feeding sheep. Feeding the Lord's sheep. What is it? It's a love for God. A love for God. And so, only a complete love for Christ, for God, in other words, would be sufficient to carry him and his fellow disciples through the careers which awaited them in the future. Peter's response undoubtedly was sincere. He had learned by this time that he could not trust himself, but he was penitent and willing to obey. He learned not to trust himself, didn't he? You remember in Matthew 16, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he told those 12 men that he chose, he said, one day, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, one day you'll travel with me back to Jerusalem and you'll see me tried, maligned, and crucified. Remember what Peter done? He trusted in himself, not in the Word of God, not in the plan and the will of God. He said, not so, Lord, be it far from me. And he carried a sword. He had it all the way through the ministry. I guess maybe the Second Amendment applied back then. I don't know. But he carried that sword because I can see him patting that sword and telling the Lord, they'll walk across my dead body before they get to you because I'll defend you. And the Lord called him a adversary. He said, get behind me, adversary. For you mind not the things of God, but the things of men. So Peter, by this time, 3 years later, has learned not to trust in himself, but trust in the Lord. You ever notice how many times we trust in ourselves and our great abilities and our great astute knowledge and all of that? Yeah. Yeah. Well, Peter had this problem, and now he's learned different now, not to rely on his trust in himself. And so, the new occupation which Jesus offered to Peter was expressed in the command, which he repeated 3 times in reply to Peter's avowal of love. I've got it on the board there. Feed my lambs, verse 15. Tend my sheep, verse 16. Feed my sheep, verse 17. Now, I see this labor of love toward one another, toward the church that he died to purchase. I see this as being foreign to the church today as we see it, because most people are just selfishly interested in their own selves. Oh, I want to be saved. And that's all they're interested in. They just talk, backbite the church that Christ died for. They talk against it. They're looking for occasions to find fault with it and everything else, rather than trying to help and feed his sheep. They're wanting to destroy it. But they want salvation for themselves. So we're selfish people by nature. And so Jesus didn't reprimand Peter for returning to fishing. He didn't do that. But he did want him to understand that fishing was not to be the main business of life. Now there's a lesson all in itself we could discuss the rest of the morning. Because in the sermon this morning, the text that we're going to look at declares that you've got to give up your life to have life. We'll talk about that later. But he didn't want him to understand that fishing was not to be the main business of life. These commands are linked with the discourse of the 10th chapter, where Jesus spoke of the sheep whom he had come to save at the cost of his own life, in chapter 10, verse 15. To whom he opened a door of safety and satisfaction, chapter 10, verse 7. And whom, as other sheep outside of Israel's fold, he must reclaim. You remember we studied that. Jesus said, other sheep have I which are not of this fold. He was talking of the Gentiles that would come into the church, the kingdom, in Acts 10. Cornelius, his household. And the Lord had quite a time trying to convince Peter to go down there, didn't he? They led a sheep down three times. And I never saw it till just right now. But how many times the Lord let that sheep down? Three times. With all these unclean animals. Here the Lord, here on this occasion, speaks to him three times. You love me, feed my sheep. You love me, feed my lambs. You love me, feed my sheep. Never saw that before, but there must be some connection between the number three there in his dealing with Peter. He was asking Peter, and through him he was asking the others also to take up the task assigned to them. Now we understand in a family that God established with us and with the human family, God's the one that established the home. He established the fact of the patriarch, the male being the head of the family, and the wife being subservient to that husband. I know I'm talking Greek now, because not too many people in our generation understand that, but that's what the Bible teaches. A woman is made as a helpmate to her husband. 1 Corinthians 11, the man is to the glory of Christ, and the woman is to the glory of man. There's a separation there. There's a division. And that's why the scriptures are pretty clear in 1 Corinthians 14 that the woman is not to speak. 1 Timothy 2, verse 7, she's not to teach nor to usurp the authority of the man. The only passage in the Bible about obedience of a woman is found primarily in Ephesians 5, where Paul said, wives, obey your husbands in all things. Nowhere does it say husbands obey your wives. When you get to Genesis and start out reading, you find out that Adam was condemned. Why? What God saith, because you've hearkened unto the voice of your wife. God didn't make man to do that. But we're living in an age where that is prevalent, isn't it? Used to be we saw movies like Father Knows Best, and now we see all our movies and Mother Knows Best. She's the smart one. Look at The Simpsons. Just one example. Old Simpson is pictured as being a blubbering idiot, and his wife is the intelligent one. Well, that's the way the world is. The words for sheep differ also. The first in verse 15 is lamb. The second in verse 16 and the third in verse 17 denotes sheep in general. All cases, all classes of believers are represented by these two groups, whether the small lambs or the grown sheep. There is an echo of this teaching in 1 Peter 5, verse 2 through 4. Tend the flock of God which is among you, exercising the oversight, not of constraint, but willingly, according to the will of God. Nor yet for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind, neither as lording it over the charge allotted to you, but making yourselves examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd shall be manifest, ye shall receive the crown of glory that fadeth not away. And so Peter's own words complete the interpretation of Jesus' charge to him here in this text. Assigning to Peter his new occupation, Jesus made a prediction concerning the future. When thou shalt be old, he says in verse 18, when thou shalt be old, another shall gird thee and carry thee whither thou wouldest not. And so the writer added this, his comment that Jesus thus described the manner of Peter's death, which implied that his fate was already known to the readers of the gospel. With characteristic impulsiveness, Peter then turned to Jesus and asked regarding the author of the gospel. He said, Lord, what shall this man do? In verse 21. And Jesus replied, if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Verse 22. And that was indicating that the next milestone in his program was his return. And so Jesus declared he's going to return right there. We don't always see that, do we? We read over those kind of things. They're like little diamonds laying there in the text, and it takes us a long time to come to see. And so the condition, if I will that you that he tarry till I come, intimated that probably the time of his return would be beyond the average span of life that any of the disciples could expect. Nevertheless, it was the ultimate objective for this present era. The work of the cross was done, and the crown was yet to come. His coming would be the time of definite reward and for the fulfillment of the divine purpose for man. With this aim in view, Jesus left the disciples his last call to faith. Verse 22, he said, follow thou me. The use of the second person singular is in the pronoun emphasizes its personal force. It was not a mass invitation, but an individual invitation. Naturally, the question would rise, if Jesus were asking these men to follow him, where was he going? Quite plainly, He was on the march toward the kingdom of which he had spoken to Pilate in chapter 18, verse 36, where Pilate asked him, "Are you king of the Jews?" And he said, "That's true, but my kingdom is not of this world, else would my servants fight." And he enjoined the disciples to fall in line. Action, not speculation, was his command. Action, not speculation. I heard a preacher when I was a boy talk about the church is the Tater family. You got those of action, you got those that are just speculators. Because you got the commentators, the agitators, the dictators, the legislators, sweet taters. The church truly is the Tater family. You got all them people with them different things about them. The explanation that Jesus had not promised that the beloved disciples would never die was intended to counteract false rumors that had become current. Unauthentic tradition was in circulation even at the time when the Gospels were written and called for correction. This conscious attempt to discriminate between truth and exaggerated rumors confirmed the authenticity of this Gospel. And so the fourth Gospel here, the Gospel of John, concludes with a note of active faith, having brought its readers to the realization of what belief is and of how it grows. It leaves him, like Peter, with a challenge to put that belief into action. In this way, the fulfillment of the purpose of John became the responsibility of the individual believer. It becomes ours. You remember John 15, Jesus showed us that he's the vine, we're the branches. And if we bear fruit, it'll be because we submit to his Father in verse 1, being the husbandman that prunes us back. And I'm sure in our community, everybody understands that a grape vineyard has no real productivity until it's pruned back where it'll produce more and more. And if we allow God, through his word, to prune us, and fine-tune that only he can do, then the Lord give us the guarantee that we would produce much fruit. But it's a matter of being attached to the vine. And like Peter, he learned not to trust in himself, but to trust in the vine. Well, that finishes all that I wanted to say about the Gospel of John. We went through, I don't know how long we've been at this in John, but I think we've roughly covered everything. I don't know what we study next. I've been here for 50 years. You realize how many times we've duplicated things? And of course, that's good because we have new people influxing into the congregation. That's true. And it's also true that we need reminding, don't we? I do, anyway. I need reminding. And when I'm studying, being 84 years old, I've been reading this Bible ever since I can remember. And every time I read it, I see things I didn't see before. They're not necessarily the things I'm talking about that I see. They're not necessarily detrimental to my salvation. But as I look deeper into the beauty of God's Word, I begin to see things that helps me tremendously. It don't add to my salvation. It just satisfies my curiosity about a lot of things. All right, that's it. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you for preparing.
Thank you for presenting. restaurant. Just right down there on the other side. There's some snacks back there.